Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Jesse Zeffel about Nola Rain, the New Orleans Banksy story. Jesse Zeffel is the author of Nola Rain, the New Orleans Banksy story. Many New Orleanians will remember the exciting time when that elusive, mysterious graffiti artist was working in New Orleans. Now Jesse Zeffel, an artist himself, the self-appointed caretaker of the image of the Umbrella Girl, fills in some of the blanks. So Jesse, tell us a little bit about what you know about Banksy.
Susan, thank you for having me today, first of all.
Thanks for coming.
Absolutely. Banksy's been a street artist since the late 90s in the UK, originally hailing from the Bristol area and expanding to London and then worldwide. He gained a lot of notoriety when he started using stencils and political themes, and he is, over the last several decades, built into one of the greatest known living artists as far as the value of his pieces and the exposure he gets. And he continues to reinvent himself and create himself. I call him a diva of the art world, just like Madonna or Cher keep reinventing themselves.
Banksy.
And you keep seeing new things. They stay relevant. They stay in the media. And Banksy continues to do the same thing.
But he inspires people in such a deep and abiding way, you know, and gets people to do work for him in a lot of ways. So, you know, a lot of people would compare it to a cult.
Absolutely. One of the things that drew me to Banksy's artwork in the first place is some of the stencils, although they're beautifully executed and great messaging, they're not necessarily complex. You could look at the Umbrella Girl itself. You could see it on the wall. It's a black and white stencil. It probably took longer to design and cut the stencil than it did to paint it.
Right.
There's no words. There's no message beyond that. So such a simple image with such a huge, impactful statement. And Banksy is infamous for doing that. And that's what always drew me to his art.
Why do you think he uses so many children in his art?
I think because we're all reminiscent and struggling and trying to process through our own childhood. Mm-hmm. So it's the most impactful thing. If you see an image with a child, it makes us reflect on our whole own existence and our foundation.
And a lot of times, I think particularly of those images of Abraham Lincoln, they're slightly stooped human beings, as if
yes.
They're a little burdened, don't you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. And Lincoln, for example, is a great example for here in New Orleans. For those that don't know, it's Abraham Lincoln pushing a shopping cart. One of the things that, at first glance, you might look at a Banksy image and it seems very simple and basic and not much thought put into it, but that is never the case. I mean, it's not by chance that Abraham Lincoln, as a young man, came down the Mississippi River and came into the city and saw the effects of slavery here and saw right. The slave trades on Esplanade, even the neighborhoods or the streets and like every little detail about a Banksy, there's so many factors that go into the secret nods about what the meaning of the piece is and why it was done, where, how, when. And so that message is great. So the Lincoln piece, at first you're like, well, why did he do Lincoln in New Orleans? But if you look at Lincoln's
yes.
history, you can then see it.
And so much is distilled in that one image. It's really amazing, I think. Now, of course, a lot of this book is taken up with the feud with Fred Radke, the Gray Ghost, which was so dramatic and got so much attention while it was going on. So talk a little bit about that, the controversy that surrounds this work.
So absolutely. Fred Radke had Operation Clean Sweep, which was an anti-graffiti organization. He was basically a vigilante. And one of the things that we say in the art world is those people that buff the artwork out, is what we call it, is to buff right. over it. Gray historically used gray, which is why he picked up the nickname the Gray Ghost. Those people kind of become street artists themselves.
They do. Right. That's the irony of all this.
There's a great documentary called Vigilante, Vigilante. It focuses on three gentlemen around the country like that, including Fred. They did an experiment with one of those gentlemen who painted, I think, with blue over everything around town. And somebody went around and covered his splotches just with pink splotches. He went back and covered those splotches with his blue. It now had become his tag, his image. And Fred Radke kind of, same thing. His ego got in the way, his passion. I think at first he was like, this graffiti is blight. And so let me counteract that. But your ego gets in the way, your passion gets in the way. And, you know, Fred did eventually set up a legal company called Operation Clean Sweep, where you could come and if there's graffiti on your building, he would come and paint over it. But he took it too far. He got legally in trouble for painting over commissioned murals. He manipulated people into painting over pieces on their buildings themselves by telling them that they were what they were doing was illegal. So Fred was very counterproductive to the street art culture of New Orleans. And so he was hated. So interestingly enough, there's tons of artwork in that era that people made that was anti-Fred and anti the Gray Ghost. And Banksy also tapped into that.
And some that contained images of Fred, ironically, to make him part of that landscape.
Absolutely. There were three pieces that included the Gray Ghost in them done by Banksy in the city.
Yeah. One of the things I love about your book is that you emphasize the reasons he came to New Orleans. And he came out of reasons of the heart, which are very appealing to me anyway. You know what I mean? But he came at a time when New Orleans needed art. We needed something to lift our eyes, above our horizon.
Absolutely. Banksy is always paying attention to the current events around the world, and he often goes and does art in places that need attention brought to them. So, 2005, of course, was Hurricane Katrina. As much media around the country and the world as there was, it was greatly ignored. And Banksy felt that he wanted to do his part to help bring global attention to that. So in 2008, on the third year anniversary of Katrina, he came and painted his 17 pieces around the city throughout the week. By chance, that weekend was Hurricane Gustav. So that was a little ironic. But absolutely, he wanted to bring attention to the systematic failure of this city and Hurricane Katrina. Many, not only here, but around the world, the people that were learning about it were disgusted by what they had seen, and he felt it needed more attention.
So when did you decide to do the book?
Well, in 2012, I went to see the Umbrella Girl on the corner of North Rampart and Kellerec, and it was protected with a sheet of plexiglass over it. Mm-hmm. And that plastic had been broken, and people were tagging not only the plastic, but painting on the Umbrella Girl. Now, you could certainly argue that street art is meant to be finite, and once it's there, it's not meant to last, and part of the beauty of it is that it comes and goes. That's a very valid point, but one could also argue that, every piece of art we see in museums or old galleries or historically preserved also could have been lost throughout time, and the Banksy New Orleans pieces, specifically the Umbrella Girl, really was very emotional for many people here. Yeah. And I thought that people trying to preserve the piece was valid. So the building was dilapidated, boarded up. I couldn't find out who the owner was at the time. So I took it upon myself to go buy a new sheet of plastic and put it up over the Umbrella Girl. And I photo documented it because I'd been photo documenting street art a little bit already at that time. And I thought that was a one and done thing. I really didn't think much about it. And I found myself at least once a month, sometimes twice a month, cleaning everything you can think of off of the piece. Because, Banksy being the most famous street artist in the world, people are drawn to it for better or worse. So people want to paint next to a Banksy or over a Banksy because they know people are going to go see it. They want attention for their piece. They want to grab onto that. Then there's people that hate on, anybody who gets popularity or fame or fortune, then that becomes the bad guy. So there's lots of people that want to deface a Banksy just because they don't think
Yeah.
It's valid. And so there's a lot of damage going on to the Umbrella Girl. And I found myself constantly cleaning the plastic. I came back a couple months later and the plastic was broken again. So I switched from plexiglass to polycarbonate, which is a harder mm-hmm. plastic. I took care of her for 12 years until the owner of the building removed it off the building in 2024. So it just became a labor of love and a passion. And the very first time I was outside taking care of the Umbrella Girl and cleaning her and putting the new plastic on her, I knew I was doing the right thing, because in the 2 hours I was out there, about 30 people stopped to talk to me. And most at first thought I was damaging it or trying to steal it, and they were defensive. But once they realized I was there trying to preserve, and we're talking homeless people, we're talking about nosy neighbors, we're talking about police, we're talking about tourists, like any walk of life you could think. Everybody was appreciative. At times, people are like, here, can I give you $20 towards the materials you're buying? People are tearing up. People are telling me stories of after the pieces were painted, every morning when they would walk by and see it, it would give them a sense of hope and know that people cared and that it was drawing attention to it. And of course, it became tourist attraction. So there was all these layers to it. And at that point, I said, preserving this piece is a valid cause. One thing led to another, and 12 years of doing that and lots of photo documentation. People over the years kept telling me, oh, you should write a book, you should write a book, you should write a book.
Yeah.
I've already written a book before. I know how much work it can be. Last thing I wanted to do was write a book. but I kept getting more and more passionate about it. I kept going down the rabbit hole, learning more stories about the 17 pieces Banksy had done here. I'd be out there cleaning her and someone would be like, oh, did you know about this or this? Or you should call this person or that person.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, it organically, the book started to develop.
And you learned so much about New Orleans in the process as
Unbelievable.
Well.
I am not originally from New Orleans. I'm from Buffalo, New York. And one of the beautiful things about this project for me is all the people that were on the art scene and in New Orleans at that time that I would have been friends with had I been living here then, I have now developed true relationships with because I tracked them down for this project.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jesse Zeffel about Nola Rain, the New Orleans Banksy story. Do you know where the Umbrella Girl is now?
So the situation with the Umbrella Girl is, like I said, when I first discovered that she needed attention, I looked up who owned the building, and it was like a shell corporation. I couldn't find who the owner of the corporation was, and it wasn't super important to me. So for probably the first 8 years of taking care of her, I didn't look any harder for the owner.
Sure.
And then there had been, where the Umbrella Girl was, a spigot that had stuck out of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And that spigot had been knocked off, but the water line was shut off to it, so there was no water coming out it. But after about 8 years or 10 years of taking care of her, all of a sudden a little bit of drip started coming out of that piping out of the wall. That water was getting behind the plastic and causing mold and fogging, and I was worried it would ruin the piece. The building was open at that point. You could just walk into the building. People were, you know, using it to sleep in or do drugs or other nefarious things. So at one point I had boarded the building shut myself because it was definitely a safety hazard. So I reopened the building. I went in. I tried to track the water line. I had no luck.
Oh.
It was buried right into the ground. I tried to shut the water off outside the building. I mean, the water was off outside the building under the cap, but there must have been a bad seal at this point. So at that point, I pursued much harder the owner of the building, found out who he was, and started a relationship via phone calls and text messages. And he was able to get the water shut off properly at that point. So we just got to a point where we had a dialogue, but he was still reserved with anything he would tell me. And when he decided to take the Banksy off the building 2 years ago, I've seen plans. He's submitted plans to the city about 4 or 5 years ago now to rehab the building. He's been looking for the right tenant to rehab the building for. The reason he removed the piece, according to what he tells me at least, is after the attempted theft of the Banksy in 2014, when they patched it back together, the architects said the corner of the building was not structurally sound, so it would have to be removed to be rebuilt. So he took the piece off and threw some new cinder blocks in there for now. And to this day, when we speak, he promises me that the full intent is when he rehabs the building, he's going to bring the piece back.
So
time will
tell. It's somewhere.
It's somewhere. I mean, I haven't seen it since it's been removed. Anything is possible. I think if it had sold in the art market world, we would have heard about it. So I don't think that it got sold. But is it coming back? Time will tell.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, when Banksy first came, he worked with a group here. He was willing to expend his energies with other people. And the group was NOLA Rising. Can you tell us a little bit about that group and what they worked on?
Absolutely. NOLA Rising was the organic main art collective in New Orleans at the time, post-Katrina. They started out by going around and putting signs up where street signs had been that they were blown away, washed away. So they started making their own street signs out of cardboard, out of wood, and putting them up. Yeah. They also started making signs that just said NOLA Rising or Have a Nice Day and all these positive messages. And their collective just took on a life of its own. And they were growing and growing and growing, getting lots of popularity, lots of charitable events they were doing, lots of community outreach. And so they were the positive driving street force in New Orleans at the time.
So that's a natural partnership.
That's absolutely natural. So there's, you know, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors around Banksy. It's hard. You know, doing this book was very tricky because it's 15 years ago. Lots of people don't remember stories correctly. Mm-hmm. Lots of people don't want to talk about the true stories they know because of the secrecy around everything. What I was able to piece together is that about a year before Banksy did come to New Orleans, one of the founding members of NOLA Rising was on European vacation and had by chance made contact with some people in Banksy's world. And they were boasting about their pride for New Orleans and for NOLA Rising. And that helped spark Banksy's interest in coming to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Maybe Banksy already had it on his radar. Maybe that's what triggered it in the first place. There's a lot of gray area on that. When Banksy came to town with his people, he was very secretive. He actually did not work directly with NOLA Rising right. when he was here. There's a lot of controversy around that statement, but from everything that I've been able to put together, you know, I've become friends with many of the founding members of NOLA Rising. They've become some of my true friends, and a couple people met him and his crew here and there, but for the most part, Banksy wanted no direct contact or exposure by anyone. And so although he was partially motivated by NOLA Rising, mm-hmm. they didn't actually work on the project here together.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jesse Zeffel about NOLA Rain, the New Orleans Banksy story. Now, some of these images are so iconic. Let's talk about a few of them. Like, one of my very favorites is the marching band on Thalia Street.
Absolutely. So that piece, it's also hard to tell in the 3-4 days he was painting in what order they were painted. Mm-hmm. You can figure out going through old Flickr web pages of where people used to photo document before the other social medias like Facebook and Instagram. You can kind of figure out like, oh, this is the first piece someone put a picture up of, but you don't really know which ones were painted first. The marching band is arguably, if not the first, one of the very first. It was on an abandoned, boarded up building. There's not very many pictures out there of it.
I know, right? That just breaks my heart.
And it's a beautiful piece. It's, for those that don't know, it's a marching band wearing gas masks that can symbolize so many things. And that piece, the next day, when Banksy and his people drove by to check on it, see what was going on with it, maybe they wanted to touch something up real quick. It's undetermined why they went back to the scene of the crime. But when they did, the piece was being painted over by someone at the building. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty about the specifics on that. Some reports say that the person that was out there painting it over mm-hmm. told Banksy's people, we were not paid for this piece to go on our wall, and we were not asked permission, so we are covering it. Banksy recently, in a book called Cut and Run that he put out, just a couple years ago, he actually had that image is in the book, and he states that he was told that they covered it because there was a brothel inside and they didn't want any attention. Across the street from that building was a auto repair shop that was run by a motorcycle gang. And after the piece was painted over, the motorcycle gang put their logo over it on that wall. So there's a couple possibilities there. They might have done that just to kind of claim their territory. They may have done that to just know that, oh, people are coming to look for this Banksy here. We want the attention. We'll put our piece up. So it is very possible that the motorcycle gang in that abandoned building across the street was selling drugs, running prostitution. Any of those things are possible, but I was never actually able to verify that.
Your block-by-block knowledge is astounding. I
mean, thank you.
You've obviously spent time.
Yes. To backtrack, to answer your question about how long I was working on the book, you could say I was working on it the whole 12 years I took care of the Umbrella Girl.
Sure.
But really, it became a book project that took about 6 years to do the book.
Yeah, but to think that that image came and went so quickly.
As many did and do.
It's really, yeah, it's I don't know. And then let's talk about the rat.
So there were a few rats. Which one specifically are you talking about?
The rat with the broom and the apron.
Absolutely. So that was right in the bend of where North Rampart and St. Claude meet in the Maroney Triangle area. Mm-hmm. And that was on a house on a wooden structure. So even in 2008, although Banksy was not quite the household name he is today, and his pieces were worth tens of thousands of dollars instead of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Still at that time, an easily stolen Banksy is a quickly stolen Banksy. So that piece was on a wooden house, and within a week, it was a rat holding a broom that was probably two clapboards high, so maybe under 2 feet tall, foot and a half tall. So that piece, I've heard two things. I heard it was stolen, and I also heard the woman who owned the building at the time cut it out to save it and preserve it. Again, I went down the rabbit hole looking for that woman's family. It seemed like the woman was deceased. I tried to find anybody with a last name, contact family. Mm-hmm. I was not able to make contact with anybody that was related to the owner of the building at the time. And that is one of the pieces that has never been publicly seen since its removal. And I have not yet been able to track it down.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jesse Zeffel about Nola Rain, the New Orleans Banksy story. I'd want you to tell the story of Sean Cumming and the Looters piece as well.
Absolutely. So Sean Cummings, who's a local project developer, he owns a hotel and rental properties and stuff, International House Hotel. He's a big player in the city of New Orleans. He's very passionate about art and street art and history.
Yes.
He's a great man to speak to. He's one of the few people I've ever talked to that never interrupts you. And he sits and listens to everything you have to say. And then he pauses before he responds. And it's so amazingly unique. It's almost awkward, but it's beautiful. Oh, so Sean owned a building on Elysian Fields down towards near the Mississippi at the bottom of Elysian. And his business partner at the time of that building got a phone call saying, "This is someone from Banksy's team. We're painting pieces here this week in the city. Can we paint on that building?" And they kind of didn't believe, come on,
yeah,
this isn't Banksy calling us. But they gave permission and said, "Yes, you're absolutely free to paint on our building."
And then did they stake it out?
They did not. They did not. I would have.
I would have.
Within a couple days, that piece magically appeared. And over time, they tried to protect it. They tried to cover it. But it kept getting defaced. The building was dilapidated and falling apart. Sean had plans to do stuff with that property that never developed. So the building was going to get demolished. So when Sean was bowing out of that project, he had the foresight to cut that section of wall out. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking, that's probably a 15,000-pound chunk of wall. It's got to be 8 feet tall and 12 feet wide, maybe a little larger than that. And the piece was covered with layers of paint and stickers and wheat paste and all these things. So the art was not very visible at the time. It's also sun faded and all these things. So Sean took the piece into storage and over time had a few people try and work on cleaning it up. He got to a certain stage where they were worried about damaging the piece. At that point, he had a couple different companies work on it. At that point, he brought in Elise Grenier, who is a phenomenal art conservator here in New Orleans, who works around the world. And she's actually worked on four of the Banksys here in New Orleans now, but that was the first one she worked on. And she painstakingly worked to clean up the things on top of it to bring it back to life. And then a few years ago, Sean, who owns the International House Hotel at 212 Camp Street, he had the piece put there. And keep in mind, again, 15,000-pound piece.
It's amazing. He's one of the few people who could deal with something.
Right. It's not an easy nor cheap thing to accomplish.
Right.
But they at a warehouse in the Bywater where Elise had secretly been working on the piece, they did a reveal and they did a film and a speech panel about the piece there. And then after that, it was moved to the hotel. The piece exists currently in the International House Hotel lobby. It's free for anybody to come in off the street and see. You don't have to be staying at the hotel. You don't have to spend any money.
Which I'm sure Banksy appreciates, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, you could say, once something leaves its original spot on the street, it loses some of its context. You lose its environment.
True.
That's totally true. But if you don't want to see it disappear, and the only other option is disappearing, having put somewhere for free in public display could arguably be the next best option.
Right.
You will get people that argue, all sides of such arguments, and I don't think there is a right or wrong answer.
We've been talking with Jesse Zeffel, who's the author of Nola Rain, The New Orleans Banksy Story. Thank you so much, Jesse.
Susan, thank you very much for having me.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. Author Christian John Wycain will be in conversation with DJ Soul Sister to celebrate the local launch of his book, A Night at the Disco, Thursday, May 28th at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, the Symphony Book Fair Sale 2026 will be held at the UNO Lakefront Arena on Saturday, May 30th and Sunday, May 31st. Sale hours on Saturday are from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. There is an entrance fee from 9 a.m. until 12 p.m. on Saturday only. There'll be free entrance after 12 p.m. on Saturday and all day on Sunday. Sale hours on Sunday are from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. There'll be a special children's book sale on Sunday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. where children accompanied by an adult can decorate a shopping bag, then fill it with selections from our children and young adult tables. There are more than 50 different categories of books, including fiction, mysteries, sci-fi and fantasy, cookbooks, history, religion, the South, art, and biography. There will also be artwork, frames, sheet music, CDs, audiobooks, DVDs, vinyl records, puzzles, and games. All proceeds benefit the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. For further information, visit www.lpovolunteers.org.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.